My guest on Simply Folk is Stephen Wade, musician, acclaimed producer and performer, and in a role we're exploring today, researcher and author. Stephen Wade's new book, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, presents the stories behind 13 field recordings made for the Library of Congress in the 1930s and 1940s. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you came.
And me too.
You brought a couple of banjos with you. Well, before we start, I want to say that the book is just lovely.
Thank you.
It's, I think the Wall Street Journal called it a masterpiece of humane scholarship. What a wonderful quote.
That reads like a detective story as the rest of it. I memorized that one. It was a wonderful thing, very generous. And I spent 18 years on it.
18 years?
Yeah.
What was the impetus for the book?
Well, when I was a little kid, I started hearing these recordings. My teacher, my banjo teacher at Fleming Brown in Chicago, had told me, you go to the library, Chicago Public Library, where they were available, and go and listen to those recordings. And they were so fascinating because the sounds of life were present in them. You could hear roosters crowing and trucks driving by, and sometimes a neighbor interrupting or talking in the background, kitchen clocks ticking. So there was this foreground of music and background in life, and it was just audible equivalent to certain experiences I'd had even younger of watching the great blues players in Chicago and some of the taverns where they played. I was too young to go in, but I'd see them and our door would be swung open during a matinee and hear and see the audience understand what they're doing. It's sort of born of shared experience. And even though in that certain street performer I'd seen in Chicago, it just art was wherever you find it. And that was so clearly reiterated by these recordings. And so the idea came up in 1994 that I put together an album, a CD called, and it became and came out in 1997 on a rounder called A Treasury of Library of Congress Field Recordings. And what I did there is I picked 30 songs that have been issued by Library of Congress over the years in their various 78s and then LPs. And I went to all the places where all the recordings were, and I sought out the players themselves, their families, and their communities. And even by the time the album came out, I was already signed with University of Illinois Press to do this book. And when I finished it, originally the manuscript was 900 pages, but nobody would want to read a book the size of a New York phone book. And so I cut it down and made each chapter its own story and its own really essay in a sense.
Well, and you're quite a storyteller because, boy, you've gotten into some interesting situations writing this book, from having a gun pointed on you during one of your interviews.
Well, I didn't know it at the time.
Thankfully. Well, yeah. Why did you choose the actual 13? Was it based on getting access and those made the best stories?
Well, there's certainly that element of best stories, but I actually researched all 30 songs, and I think, and you know what, there could be 300 other songs or 3 million other songs. All these stories are fascinating. These 13, well, I distributed this in terms of male, female, young, old, white, black. They're all Southern, so there's that unity, but I loved all of these songs for their capacity for renewal. I mean, a lot of the particular songs in my book have entered into larger places, whereas many of these performers, this is just a day in their lives and for their families and for them, but not have really been much present for them. And yet, for all of us, their performances have become present. The opening song in the book, the Bonaparte's Retreat. In Bonaparte's Retreat, this fiddler is a nearly anonymous Kentucky fiddler who continues to play for millions.
Now listen to Bonaparte. That's the Bonaparte.
Wonderful to hear them talking during the recording.
That's Fiddler Bill Stepp himself saying, that's the bony part, that's the bony part. And he's referring to the part of the tune that's richest as military connotation for Bonaparte's Retreat, which was a programmatic piece of music. Now, this piece of music, as you know, and many of your listeners will already recognize it, this is what this is transcribed in a book in 1941 by Ruth Crawford Seeger, and Aaron Copland drew from that transcription to create the Hoedown and Rodeo. And it's the music that you hear in a Beef It's What's For Dinner commercial, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer had a big hit with it. And there's other songs in the book, too, that have had this enormous dissemination, one after another, Sea Lion Woman, or Goodbye Old Paint has found its way. I could just go on, but that wasn't really why I chose it, but it does say something about the power of these individuals and their great artistry. Ruth Crawford Seeger, the lady who transcribed that song, talked about common possession and individual contribution. So these songs are in common possession. Many people know them, and they have, so the artistic responsibility for these songs are borne by many, and these individuals bring to it their own understanding of the human condition, their own abilities as players and as singers, and that happens throughout. Their artistry is abundant throughout this book.
Well, and that's the story of folk music, isn't it? Music that's handed down, and performers and everyday people make it their own, bring their own lives to it, and the music transforms. There's music that's come across from the UK that has transformed itself, and all of a sudden it becomes a prairie ballad, or I think Old Paint is one of the examples that could have been inspired by music that came from England or Scotland.
There are antecedents there, certainly. And folklore is available to everyone, no matter what their station in life, to the extent that they make themselves available. I mean, this is the informal dimension. It's not just music, of course. It just goes beyond only music. I mean, people sitting around a dinner table when they sneeze and they say something in the family. There's just a zillion traditions. There's an infinite number of combinations that occur in that part of our, in that informal part of our life. So much communication happens that way. And these people are gone, but this process, of course, it just goes on and on.
Continues to the end. We're the beneficiaries of it. Well, you are quite a master of the banjo, and you've been studying for a long time.
Yeah.
Is there an example of a tune that you have made your own and given your own spin to?
Well, that's sort of the job, to do them all that way, I guess. I never really put it that way. Well, why don't I just start on something old here on a fretless banjo? This thing looks like a little axe handle, really. It's all plain and no frets, wires that go separate the notes from one another. This is made in Western North Carolina.
Sound, boy, and so chromatic. And oh, look at that! He's turning the banjo over, and there's a big hole in the back of it.
Yeah, a little piece of drain pipe holding the possum skin type pad in there. Yeah.
That's possum skin.
That's what they were made out of, possum skin and raccoon skin. And the fellow made this. He talked about cat skin, and his uncle had said that. Saw a cat walk by, and he said, "Well, that's a banjo on four legs."
Oh, that's kind of gruesome for those of us who.
Yeah, that family didn't want to hear. They lost their pet. Yeah, well, I know. I have six, so I love them. I do know what you mean.
I'd like to read a couple of sentences from your book. I just thought your language, your use of language is so lovely. And you were talking about living in Chicago, growing up with some of the wonderful performers that were there. And here's what I. What caught my eye, in the mid-1960s, as a fledgling preteen electric guitarist too young to enter the taverns where Muddy and Wolf appeared, and there, of course, you're talking about Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, I sometimes stood outside during matinees and listened to them by the front window. If I got lucky, the bouncer swung the front door open, allowing fresh air to thin the reek of Blatt's beer and the fog of Salem cigarettes, and permitted me to peer inside. So you've been entranced with this world since you were really a youngster.
Boy, yeah. And then my guitar teacher at that time, I was someone who lives right here in Madison. That was Jim Schwall.
Oh, he's a wonderful performer.
Yeah, and his band was opening for some of those acts. That was how that all worked, that mechanism there. And so they were inside because they were older than me, you know, those guys. And they hadn't recorded yet. This is, we're talking here, 1963, 64. And sort of like this all my life and still do.
Well, not only is the book filled with scholarship, certainly, and research, but it's done in a way that is really readable, and the stories are interesting.
Well, bless your heart.
Well, why don't you tell us about the story behind Rock Island Line?
Oh, well, you know, I don't make a big deal about it in my book, but there's something about what happened there that happened for me, and it was really once in a lifetime. And I can never expect this moment to happen again. I was lucky it ever happened in the first place. In folklore and in folk song study, one always seeks origins, but one never finds origins, hardly. There are individuals write these songs, then many people reshape them. Every folk singer is a folk composer, according to Philip Sperry, the great scholar from Harvard in the 30s, and he was right. At the same time, we know that there's individuals behind these things. Well, there were some recordings that were made in the fall of 1934, two of them, just a week apart, at two different units, the Arkansas State Prison, of prisoners singing Rock Island Line. It was clear to me from listening to them, and this song had no commercial dissemination before then, never been recorded, is that obviously it had a prior existence. And I thought, well, maybe some railroader someplace commented on it. I just didn't. It was possible. I mean, obviously, songs had a life before they got to those Cummins Prison Farm and this other prison. And so I found out there was a Rock Island magazine. The Rock Island Railroad had been publishing magazine for years and years and years, and there was one library in America that had them in there. So through an interlibrary loan program, they're all sent out to where I live in Washington, D.C. area, and all these boxes came. And it was a really thick magazine. It was like each issue was like a quarter inch thick. And it was this really small type. It was an era when people actually did read, you know. And so I started going through them page after page every month. They didn't miss it for decades of this magazine coming through. And I realized, of course, that there were a lot of songs that were written about the Rock Island Railroad by people who worked there. In fact, the railroad was encouraging its ticket takers and its conductors and its repair shopmen to write songs. Said the more business, you know, more you write songs, the more we advertise, the more passengers you have, more secure your job is. And they were very bald about it. And these were called booster songs. And of course, the booster movement, you know, it still goes on. I know where I live, or construction companies have, you know, sponsor soccer teams for the Spanish workers there, group solidarity, fraternalism, as well as getting the name of the construction company out in front of others. So I'm looking through these magazines, you know, and all I had to do with this particular issue, with this particular page, I mean, this was news from the local, which was an extra small type at the back of the magazine, was just, you know, look away, a pretty girl would walk by or I'd sneeze or something like that would happen. And I just, my eyes fell upon it. And there it was. It was a description. It was the lyrics of what was obviously the original version of Rock Island. It said, who wrote it? These were men who worked at the Biddle repair shops. It named the author himself. It named in the song people who were their bosses who were in the audience that night at this church in Little Rock, at this Arch Street church, this particular day, time, the whole thing, a booster song. And they'd written it for it. And they're talking about workplace, you know, all these things I just mentioned to you. It's just, it was all there. I was so shook up when I saw that thing. I tried calling my editor in Chicago, at Illinois Press, rather. There was a touch tone phone there in the library. It took me three times to dial it. I mean, I just couldn't do it because I knew what I was looking at. And so by 4 years later, by the time it's recorded, it was simplified, improved. A lot of the specific references are dropped away because they're not going to be remain. They're not going to remain tradition because they have no connection to anybody. And so the song changed from sort of commerce to travel. And the Rock Island Line itself is the oldest railroad line in Arkansas, about 133 miles from, you know, Little Rock to Memphis. And I drove it. I drove right along beside the whole thing, just trying to learn about it, and had a little tape recorder in my hand to sort of make out. But observations, and I got to know the family of the man who recorded the song for the library, and it was on that trip that Leadbelly, the singer Leadbelly, was the driver and song demonstrator and manservant, really, for John A. Lomax, and he learned the song on that trip, and he changed it into its own creative form, which becomes related to work song, but in the original version, in the version that's on the CD that comes in the back of my book, and maybe you can play a little bit of the Rock Island Line in a moment, that's a quartet song, and the song that was in that magazine I found from 1930, well, they were a part of a, that was quartet music, a gospel singing form. So to discover that original Rock Island Line, well, I just sort of lay it in there, but to tell you the truth, Stephanie, I mean, that's really what happened. And I knew I was fortunate. So my editor and my wife and I all sort of made blood oaths not to tell anybody until Darn Book came out, which was last September. And there it was for the world to know. So it puts the clock back a little bit on where that song really starts.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a road to ride.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road.
If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Will Jesus died to save me and all of my sin. Oh, while it's glory to God, we're gonna meet him again. I said the Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a road to ride.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
I was kind of surprised to hear that beautiful harmony. You know, I've heard so many solo versions of it, but how neat.
And the other prisoners at the other prison a week earlier, they also sang it as a harmony song. So that and as I said in the magazine, it was clearly that way too.
Well,
the Little Shop Singers.
Something that was so interesting about your book is that these recordings were made of prisoners. They were made of students, school children, of housewives, former miners and farm laborers, just really a huge cross-section.
Yeah, American people.
And what was the use of these songs in their lives?
Well, for the mom, for that housewife, it had a functional purpose, put her kids to sleep. These songs ballad scholars might, you know, say this is this kind of ballad or that kind of ballad, but everything for her was a lullaby, let me tell you. and it served a good purpose. And she had a big brood of kids, and so the songs were for entertainment, of course. For Kelly Pace, who just led the Rock Island Line. I mean, he was known in his prison. He was in and out four times for saying, as a songwriter. He and his brother told me, you know, he'd always been kind of a songwriter, charismatic guy. He's very skillful. He said in many ways, you know. He could chunk a rock and hit a rabbit. You know, I mean, he had a lot of skills. He could dance real well. And he obviously could lead these group of fellow prisoners in song. And he was a wonderful singer himself. And that was the lead singer on that.
What was the recording process for most of these songs?
Well, they often ventured beyond the electrical grid. So you had direct current batteries, big car batteries, essentially. And these were called instantaneous acetates. So they were cut from the inside out, and there was a worm gear holding down the stylus. And every single family member that I spoke to, without exception, remembers this ribbon of acetate snaking along the floor as it's cut away, as the thing is cutting from the inside out, by the way. And sometimes when you're listening to these playbacks, because the direct current batteries have gone down, the voices go up, and so you've got to recalibrate it and stuff to find the right pitch.
I remember one of the stories in your book of, you know, they were always asking if there was electricity available. And in one circumstance, they went to the local church because one of the family members took care of the church.
That's right. That's in Sea Lion Woman. That's mm-hmm. a good one. And, you know, a lot of people have heard that one, too. So that might work well for your program because people will recognize the Sea Lion Woman. There they had electricity and what was so great about that recordist, Herbert Halpert, is that every time he did a recording, he always blew on a little pitch pipe. So we really had a basis to know what speed the darn thing really went at. And that was very helpful in our little in our digital age, let me tell you.
Why don't we hear Sea Lion Woman?
And at the very beginning of it, they're talking to him about the song, and then they sing it. The two sisters, this is Christine and Catherine Shipp, and I got to know their older brother Isaac, who taught them the song, and he learned it from their grandfather, who was ex-slave, and so this song, and he played it on the fiddle, and so this song just keeps transforming, and it's still being sung. I mean, there's pop versions, and you may have heard. Leslie Feist, you know, she took the combined the Shipp Sisters' chorus with the words from Nina Simone, and Nina Simone had a wonderful hit with it. Her bass player had written new words for it. She grew up by North Carolina, so she had it from her own past. These children are from Byhalia, Mississippi, and when I went to see their family, they had no idea their mother said even. That song had not gone on in that family. I mean, it was a song of childhood. Their mothers, if they did any singing at all, was singing done in a church. So it was really wonderful to share this with them, and even more wonderful for them were the two photographs that were taken. The same person took the cover of my book, Abbott Ferris. He's in his late 90s now, and he knows his pictures on the cover of the book. He took two photographs of that family, one of which is in the chapter that you saw, and the family was really most interested in seeing the pictures.
Oh, the pictures are wonderful. Well, let's close our conversation with Sea Lion Woman, and then we'll say goodbye to Stephen just after that.
Name of this song is Sea Lion Woman. Well, I learned it when I was small, too.
Well,
little puppy, rather.
We sung this song when we was playing. We just things and we just want to have something to be saying. We didn't know much of anything to play. We just sang this song. Wasn't in action at all. Just all be just moving around and jumping around from place to place.
Sea Lion Woman, sea lion. She drank coffee, sea lion. She drank tea, sea lion. And again, the last sea lion. Way down yonder, sea lion. Behind the log, sea lion, and the rooster crowed, sea lion, and again the lion, sea lion. Sea lion woman, sea lion, she drank coffee, sea lion, she drank tea, sea lion, and again the lion, sea lion. Sea lion woman, sea lion, she drank coffee, sea lion, she drank tea, sea lion, and again the lion, sea lion.
My guest has been Stephen Wade, and the name of his book is The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings and the American Experience. It was released on the University of Illinois Press, along with a CD with 13 tracks of the music behind these stories. And
in the back of the book, it's 50 pictures, 504 pages.
It was wonderful historic photographs.
Thank you so much.
Yep. It was a pleasure meeting you today, Stephen,
yes.
And talking with you. And thanks for sharing all of the research and the music. And nice to hear a little bit of your banjo playing as well.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Stephanie.